From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, June the 3rd, 2020, and we have a good full show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be speaking first in just a minute or so with Kevin McCollum. He is a reporter for 7 days and has been doing an excellent job covering the State House and politics and so on since his arrival, I think, from California not too long ago, maybe a year ago now. We'll check in on all that in a couple of minutes with Kevin. But later on in the second part of this hour, we're going to be speaking with Chief George Merkel of the Virgins Police. He is also president of the Vermont Association of Chiefs of Police and issued an interesting statement about the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and, of course, all the reaction to that over the past 9 or so days, since that happened. And Chief Merkel will be my guest from about 9:35 to 10. And then in the second hour, we are going to be, I think, talking to one of our CBS News correspondents near the top of that, and then going to a pair of people who are on opposite sides of a question about the future of Vermont's dairy industry. A blogger, former journalist, longtime lobbyist around Montpelier, and now blogger Kevin Ellis is going to be joining me. He has a very provocative piece out this week talking about how the state shouldn't be devoting COVID emergency money, as it's proposed to do, to the dairy industry in Vermont. The dairy industry in Vermont is in big trouble economically. It's got some environmental issues, etc. Kevin thinks it ought to be allowed to just sort of wither away. I'm going to pair him, though, with a young and very dynamic dairy farmer from Orange County by the name of Mary White. And, boy, she is a big defender and booster of the dairy industry in Vermont. Doesn't want to hear a word of this. So we're going to keep it civil, but there will be some pointed discussion here, I think, about the future of dairy in Vermont in the second hour of the program today. So that should be interesting as well. But let's start right off with Kevin McCollum this morning. Kevin, good piece you have coming out today in 7 days. I got you folks are helping me out a lot by giving me a little bit of an advance warning about what's coming. And I get to, I saw the piece overnight and was able to figure out what's going on from your perspective anyway on this question of mail-in voting in Vermont. And why don't you give us the paper's not out of here. Let's call it a pre-cap instead of a recap. How's that?
Yeah, that works for me.
Okay. What are you reporting today?
Well, so when 7 days hits the street in a few hours here, there's a story in there that I think is headlined "One Person, One Stamp," and it tries to get to the bottom of why the issue of whether the state should switch to a mail-in vote in November is such a contentious issue in Vermont. Obviously, nationally, there's been a lot of talk about doing this. There's been a lot of partisanship on it. There's been a lot of vitriol. The president has been attacking the concept of mail-in voting as ripe for fraud. That, as I think, bled down into the local debate a little bit. And what you're seeing is this protracted disagreement between Republicans and Democrats in the state of Vermont about whether we should go forward with mail-in voting.
Yeah, it's interesting. The legislation passed earlier this year basically set up the governor and the secretary of state, who are, of course, from two different parties. Jim Condos is a Democrat, and Governor Phil Scott is a Republican, and they were tasked with basically coming up with a decision about mail-in voting for Vermont this year, and more specifically, a decision about whether to basically send ballots out to all voters for the November election, which is what Secretary Condos wants to do. But this partnership has not been super smooth. What can you tell us about that?
No, so you're absolutely right. The legislature figured, well, you know, if we're going to have a change to the elections that the state of Vermont has in 2020, given the coronavirus pandemic, let's allow that to happen. Let's give the Secretary of State wide berth here and let him make some judgment calls about how to do elections differently. Maybe we could have mail-in voting. Maybe we could have drop-off boxes. Maybe we could have extended hours. They had all these ideas about how they should do elections differently. And there was a push to just allow him to make those changes. And then there was a little pushback on that, and they said, well, you know, we don't want one party making all the decisions about how the elections in 2020 ought to go. Let's make sure that Governor Phil Scott has a role in that decision. So they crafted the legislation to say that Jim Condos had the power in consultation and agreement with Governor Phil Scott. So that's how the legislation originally was framed. And then what happened was the two men started to go back and forth by mail, largely in letters, formal letters to one another, saying, here's what I'd like to do. And then Governor Scott would say, well, I have some concerns about that. So you're absolutely right. Jim Condos thinks the best way to hold an election in the middle of a pandemic is to do it by mail-in vote, if possible, to mail everybody a ballot. A person would sign that ballot, would fill out the ballot, sign under penalty of perjury that they are who they say they are, mail it back to their town clerk, and they're done. They could also take it down to the poll if they polls if they still wanted to do that. But that's what the Secretary of State thought would be the best course of action. And the governor said, I have some concerns with that. I think we're jumping the gun. I think I'd really like to get us back to a state of normalcy. We're doing it in all the other industries and areas of the state, slowly but surely. Why can't we do it in our elections? And then he raised several other concerns. I think one of them was, what was some of his other concerns? Do you recall? I mean, I know he wanted to return to normalcy, and I know he didn't want to be the one to make the decision. I mean, he didn't think that two elected officials ought to be, who were on the ballot, should be making a decision about how that ballot should be voted on. So they They couldn't agree, basically, and the legislature had to step in and say, well, we've just got to give this power to Jim Condos, and that's where they are now.
Yeah, and I mean, I thought the governor's kind of remarks and stance about this were sort of interesting, where he's essentially saying that, you asked to hear from me on this, and if you didn't want to hear from me, you shouldn't have asked me.
Right.
I mean, I think there's a little bit of irony there or something, and I think he sees the irony there, and I don't think really he was particularly comfortable with this role to begin with.
I think you're absolutely right. I think he didn't. Yeah. He has said in press conferences that he did not ask for this responsibility. And it was given to him, and they asked him what he thought about this mail-in voting thing, and he told them what he thought, that it was premature, that it was, and he gave him all these reasons, and he said, yeah, well, you asked. And if you want
to... It's like somebody's nudging him and saying, no, Governor, you're supposed to tell them what they want to hear.
Yeah. So
I shouldn't be.
Really, and so they said, okay, well, we'll take you out of the equation.
I shouldn't be so flip, but I mean, it sort of feels that way watching this whole thing go down. And I mean, you got to look at the merits of the thing too. I mean, if you say that the Secretary of State is the chief elections officer in the state and the buck stops there as far as the conduct of our elections, maybe it makes sense to have him fly solo on this thing, regardless of who the party.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think a lot of lawmakers feel that way right now, that they feel that it makes total sense to have the chief elections official be the one to make the decision. And the idea of having Phil Scott participate in that decision and share equally in that decision was ultimately not a great move. It was well-intentioned, right? They wanted to have sort of a bipartisan approach to any election change in the state, but it didn't work out. So
in many other states, Secretary of State has immense powers over the conduct of their elections, including the conduct of, their presidential elections and all the state and local elections, and that's pretty typical around the country. And sure enough, secretaries of state are often accused of being partisan in their conduct of elections. I mean, you look at Georgia, the most recent election for governor down there, where it was the Secretary of State who ends up getting elected governor, and a lot of questions raised there. And so, this is little bit of hardball, but I mean, it's something that shouldn't be completely foreign to anybody either.
Right,
I think it's
right. And the reason I wanted to, so we'd written a version of that story a couple times in the last 3 weeks, because these guys have been kind of in a standoff from more than a month now, going back and forth with different proposals, and you know, maybe we'll make the decision in August, and back and forth, and but I wanted to do this story that comes out in 7 days today to focus a little more on why the two parties seem to disagree on the merits and efficacy of a mail-in balloting program. They're really, if you think about it, it didn't immediately make any sense to me why Democrats would seem to be largely in favor of expanding of mail-in voting, switching to mail-in voting, and Republicans in the state would not be. And even nationally, why that would be the case, right? And so I reached out to a political science professor from Middlebury named Matt Dickinson, who was excellent and really helpful, and he helped me understand, and is in the story. He posits that there's two things going on here. So in Vermont, what has happened is that the national debate has bled down into the local debate. All of the partisan vitriol about this, all of the lawsuits that the Republican Party has launched against states that are trying to engage in mail-in voting, and all of the tweets from the president about it have kind of filtered down into the rhetoric that local politicians are using, and probably the same on the Democratic side. So that's one thing that's happening and making it a little complicated. The other part, though, he said, is that there is actually a fundamental difference between the parties about and what they view as an individual's rights and responsibilities when it comes to voting. And he said basically that the Republicans generally feel more like it is the responsibility of the voter to overcome any hurdles that might stand in their way to vote. This is the foundation of democracy, and it's your responsibility to do it. Whereas Democrats feel that it's far more important to remove the barriers to voting that exist throughout this nation and historically have existed in this nation. So his point was that, look, even if you suggest that there's maybe people jockeying for partisan advantage here, then the mail-in ballot debate, the mail-in voting debate, there's also an underlying philosophical difference between the two parties about voting and how it should be conducted, which I found.
Matt Dickinson has actually been a guest on the show a few times, a very thoughtful gentleman who is a political science professor at Middlebury. And he actually, I thought he made a really good point there that there is some, and that's not surprising given that, Republicans typically are less friendly to, you know, government benefits for people than Democrats are. So the whole idea of, does government take a more proactive role in helping people, or are people asked to be more self-reliant? That's right. A theme. And and so it shows up here in this surrounding elections. I mean, I there are always caveats and sort of asterisks and so on. Among which are that, in some places and throughout United States history, certainly there have been barriers set up to voting, which were, frankly, not well-intentioned. Many of them racist in character, for one thing, and so on. And so I think there's a wariness, especially on the part of Democrats, and a desire by Democrats to expand the franchise as much as it can be. It's a constant tug back and forth here,
right.
Which shows up in different ways in different places, and it's a little fascinating to me to see that a governor, rather, who has so strongly disagreed with the president on so many things, is a little bit on the same page on this question.
Well,
is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. That was another reason I was drawn to the story, because if you think about it. And you listen to what many of the Republicans in the state, including Phil Scott, were saying about mail-in balloting. They were taking great pains to say that they were not merely towing the party line, the National Republican Party line on this issue in any way, that they didn't have, like, and the governor made great pains to say that he actually did not believe that mail-in voting poses a substantial fraud risk, that that was not mm-hmm. his concern at all. And you're like, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. The Republican governor, you know, is on the same page as the Republican president, but he has a different explanation. And then you start drilling down in the different explanations, and you kind of go, huh, okay. You know, it's like a, it's kind of yeah. a dull kind of timing argument. And you wonder, is that really what's going on here? Like, or is he just coming up with a different explanation that is more palatable and distances himself from the president while still being on the same page as the president and the Republican Party? So, you know, and we saw that in the, we saw a degree of that difference with the Republican Party position in Vermont on this. The Republican Party in Vermont is very much of the belief and strongly put out a statement saying that they are seriously worried about voter fraud. And so it is odd that some of the explanations being used by the politicians in this debate might not be the complete picture. So I found that interesting as well.
Well, and some of the fledgling conservative media in Vermont, including like True North Reports, mm-hmm. been very out there on the question or trying to promote the idea that there's going to be rampant fraud if we allow this to happen.
Yeah.
Secretary of State Jim Condos, meanwhile, is really, I think, you know, his focus lately has been on COVID and its possible lingering effects into the fall. I mean, people talk about a possible resurgence of this of the virus in the fall, and I think a lot of this debate kind of got kicked off, frankly, with the footage everyone saw from Wisconsin on their primary day,
right,
where, you know, people were standing in line at the polls for hours on end trying to maintain 6 feet of social distancing. You know, some folks ended up not being able to vote, and et cetera. It ended up being kind of a nightmare out there. And I think that certainly had an effect here, don't you think?
I do, yeah. No, and so because of that, for that exact reason, we decided that we would go to South Burlington last week and see how the in-person voting on the school budget was being conducted, because as I'm sure you're aware, there was a revote on the school budget, $54 yep. million dollars, and there was no time to do an election like that by mail, right? And so mm-hmm. we went yep. and we talked to people and we watched them all dutifully march in with their wearing their masks and staying 6 feet apart, and we talked to the town clerk, the city clerk there, and it was fascinating, because even the poll workers that I spoke with seemed to feel that the measures that they were able to put in place, everything from wearing masks to social distancing to elaborate face shields to sanitizing the pens after people were done using them,
yeah.
they felt that they really could conduct an election in this environment safely. For two reasons. One, because of all those safety measures, and two is because of Vermont's excellent track record in combating the virus, right? That if you do draw a line out several months into November and predict that we're going to keep doing being on the trajectory we're on, you could argue that, you know, it's not going to be a major issue in November. But then you're absolutely right. A whole host of other people have stepped forward and said, whoa, 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 whoa. Don't assume that this is the end of this virus and its impact in this nation. We very well could see a resurgence in the fall. And look at the protests happening all over the country. Everyone, every scientist who studies this issue says this is almost certain to trigger a resurgence of the virus in some of these places and create hotspots that are going to be make it harder to get control of.
Yeah, what a shame that is.
Yeah,
yikes.
Yeah.
Talk about the cost of going out and making your voice heard.
Yeah.
Well, and that was a really interesting exercise. I'm so glad that you went to the South Burlington school vote last week. What was the outcome there, by the way? Do you recall?
Yeah, I think the budget went down in flames badly. They lost 64% of the vote or something.
That's what I thought I recalled, but it was kind of like.
Yeah. A lot going on.
I don't have every fact in my head all the time, folks.
Yeah,
I don't know
yeah.
if you've. I think our listeners are well aware of that by now, but just in case. Kevin McCollum is my guest. He is with 7 Days and has been covering this issue of mail-in voting in Vermont. Really, I think, doing an excellent job getting both sides of the story, you know, talking to Republicans and Democrats and pointing out how this does, there's a thread here that goes right to the fundamental philosophies of these two political parties that is manifesting itself in interesting ways here. But in terms of Secretary of State Jim Condos, I wanted to circle back to him, Kevin, and sure. ask you, he does really talk about this issue of COVID, and he wants to have elections which are, I think, are just sort of logistically and functionally smooth.
Right.
And so I think his thought here seems to be that if we can get people to vote in advance by mail, you also go, for weeks before any election in Vermont these days and actually cast your ballot sort of individually at your town or city clerk's office.
That's right. But
those things, what they do is they thin out the crowds on election day.
Exactly.
And some advocates for this kind of approach actually they don't talk about election day, they talk about election season.
Right.
It's talk about flattening the curve and trying to basically just keep any sort of social infrastructure like this from being overwhelmed. That is one way you cut the crowds going to the polls on election day, is to have people vote in advance or vote by mail. So, I mean, there's some really practical considerations here, I think, that the Secretary of State is trying to apply. Meanwhile, I got to ask you before I want to really dig into this in the last few minutes here, dig into this question about possible fraud or not even so much fraud, but just sort of logistical difficulties on the mail-in ballot end of things, because the U.S. Postal Service is a human institution. It's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
The heaven knows that the voter lists in towns. Remember, the folks, it's not that everybody will get a ballot. It's that registered voters will get a ballot. Do I understand that right, Kevin?
You do, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But even so, people move and they forget to inform their city or town clerks, and so they're still on
right.
the voter list. The ballot shows up at their old address, I suppose, and then what? Right?
That's exactly one of the concerns that a lot of the clerks have, right? So you have this philosophical, you have all these different layers, which is why I find this story fascinating. And one of those key layers is that many of the people with the most direct experience in running elections, the town clerks, have waved a red flag, at least some of them, and said, hey, wait a minute, what are we doing here? You're going to mail every registered voter on this list a ballot, and they say, what will happen? What will happen if that person's not at that address anymore? Will the post office mail it back to me? Will they mail it to the forwarding address? Will they throw it in the garbage? What will happen? So, getting clear answers to all of those logistical questions has been really challenging because of how quickly the state is trying to ramp up on this, and because of how there hasn't been a final decision about whether to do it or not. So there hasn't been this education campaign, right? Jim Condos said one of the first things he needs to do once he gets the green light to go ahead and do a mail-in vote for November is do an education campaign of the clerks in the state of Vermont to give mm-hmm. them a comfort level that they can, pull this off, and then to do a public education campaign about mail-in voting so they understand how it'll work. And he's been stymied from doing that because he can't say that he's ready to move forward yet because the legislature hasn't signed off on it. But the clerks, if you speak to several of them, and I did speak to the one in South Burlington, she has significant concerns about what will happen with potential voter fraud, not because she thinks people are bad and will take advantage of every opportunity they're given, but just because the unknowns are so many more when you do a mail-in vote. I think she feels like the controls that are in place to ensure that the people who show up at the polls are the people who say they are and that no one can vote twice or whatever, that those controls maybe are lessened. So it's this push and pull, you're absolutely right, between the control of the election by the elections officials and the way they have been doing it for years and years, and and this desire to expand it and make it easier and make it safer, there's just a lot of resistance to changing the way we've done something for hundreds and hundreds of years. But I also want to point out that we have absentee balloting now. 30% right. of people who vote in the state of Vermont choose to just get a ballot, fill it out, and mail it back in at their leisure. And all mail-in balloting really does is try to push that number, as you say, as high as possible so that the turnout at the polls, which is expected to be, well, the turnout in the election in November is expected to be very high. And so they're yeah. just trying to say, wait a minute, let's get the numbers at the polls as low as we possibly can by having mail-in balloting for, as you say, weeks and weeks before the election.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know if you have my strategy as a reporter, Kevin. But when years I was working for the AP, I would typically vote early only because I figured I'm going to be really busy on election day.
Yep.
So that's that. Yeah, and so you know that is something. So the bottom line here is a decision has to be made in order to get ballots to the printers and order all the envelopes, et cetera, if that's the route. By what date, do you know?
Well, I think Jim Condos has said that he would have preferred to have this decision made by the end of April. They blew that
Yikes.
Deadline badly. And so now, and he, I think last week, said essentially that they needed to make a decision. And then when they got the Senate to move forward with a bill to grant him sole authority, I think he has gone forward and started to sign some of the contracts, maybe not transfer the money, but sign some of the contracts he needs with printers to be able to conduct, you know, to buy this paper stock and get the envelopes sorted out and start that process. Jeanette White, Senator White, was on the head of this bill. She was leading the design of this bill. And she said that there's going to need to be a million and a half envelopes printed for this, because they thought they might have to do half a million mail-in ballots, but every single mail-in ballot has three envelopes: the one it comes in, the one that you have to put your ballot into, and then the one you return it to the clerk.
Yeah,
all of different sizes, all
lots of paper.
yeah, it's just yeah, exactly. So it's a complicated process to pull off.
Yep.
Other states,
Kevin,
have taken years to make the transition, and we're trying to do it in a few months. So.
All righty. I got to interrupt you and tell you that we are about out of time on this segment, but I really okay. appreciate you you joining me, Kevin McCollum of 7 Days. Stay on top of the story. We might have to be checking in with you about it again in the near future. Thanks very much.
Happy to do it anytime. Thanks.
All righty. Hey, we're going to be speaking with Virgin's police chief and president of the Vermont Police Chiefs Association, George Merkel, after the break. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour on this Wednesday morning, June the 3rd, folks. And we are trying to address various aspects of this national tragedy of a story that started in Minneapolis a week ago Monday with the death of George Floyd. He died after having having a police officer kneel on his neck for nearly 9 minutes, and three other officers were standing around and not intervening in this. And obviously, folks know there has been an outburst of anger and sadness and demonstrations and protests around the country since those events occurred in Minneapolis. And yesterday we had on the program Curtis Reed Jr., an African-American man who is the executive director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity. Curtis has done a lot of work with police departments in the state of Vermont to try to help them train officers to eradicate any racial bias that could occasionally shows up in the work. And interestingly, yes, we had a statement issued by the Vermont Association of Police of Chiefs of Police, I should say, the Vermont Association of Chiefs of Police, which represents local police departments around the state, and came out very strongly condemning the incident in Minneapolis and talking about the need for police officers to redouble their efforts to avoid these kinds of things, and also for the public in general and police officers, everyone, just to try to treat each other with a little more respect and civility and kindness and all those good things. The president of the Vermont Association of Chiefs of Police is George Merkel. He's also the police chief in Vergennes, and he joins us this morning on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And Chief, thanks very much for coming on our air.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. And I saw your statement, and I thought that it was very clear and direct in its condemnation of these acts by this Officer Chauvin of the Minneapolis police in the death of George Floyd. And we spoke earlier this morning, and you were saying that one of the real painful things about this is just that this kind of an incident tends to besmirch your entire profession. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's an understatement.
And tell us how that feels. I mean, when you see video like this one that everybody was carrying out of Minneapolis last week, what goes through you?
Well, I can tell you just within my own department, and I'm fairly comfortable speaking for everybody else that I've talked to. It was a matter of shock. It was revolting, and officers were outraged. There's no real word that can portray how we felt about that. That was horrendous. We deal with all kinds of things in the course of our duties, and dealing with violence is a terrible part of it. It leaves scars on everybody involved, both the victim and the officer that is responding to it and whatever else. But when it comes from one of our own officers, that's terrible.
Yeah, and I have to ask you, too, about And I want to get into a little bit of the specifics of police training and how to respond to something like this. But you're in a group of officers. You're one of four at the scene of, what turns out here to have been a very petty crime. I mean, the passing of a counterfeit $20 bill, I think, is what they were accusing Mr. Floyd of. And so you have four officers on the scene, and one of them, I mean, I can sort of imagine one person just really losing his cool, on a very individualized basis, essentially having, what amounts to a temper tantrum and starting to do something that is very dangerous. You know, I mean, obviously kneeling on somebody's neck is a very dangerous thing. The part of the equation I cannot get to, frankly, is how the other three guys don't pull him off. What do you think happened there?
I can't answer that. I can't tell you what happened. I can just tell you that everybody that's watched that video, I mean, whether you be civilian or police, has asked the same question. How can you stand there and let that happen? And I can't speak for those people out there. I can just tell you that the kneeling on the man's neck is not an accepted practice, never should have happened, and the other officers should have intervened. There's no excuse for that, and again, there's no explanation for that. There is absolutely none. And one thing I want to make it clear: when I said one of our officers, that individual is not one of our officers. Vermont officers, that's not Vermont. That may have happened somewhere else, but I want to clarify that, because when I said that, he's not one of our officers. That's not a practice. That's just not an accepted way of controlling a person. You don't do that. That has lethal consequences, as we saw. And why these officers didn't intervene, I can't answer for them, but I can tell you they should have, absolutely. And I can speak for my department that if anybody ever did do that, which I can't believe that would ever happen, I don't believe that would ever happen, I can tell you that somebody would be grabbing that officer, yanking them off, and probably putting them in the cruiser and telling them to go back to the office. And then we would address that after the situation was dealt with. But that is not, as you can see, the disastrous consequences. There's no excuse for that.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, and it's the much more normal behavior from everything I know. And I'll tell you a little story about an incident, like sort of where one police officer was going off, frankly, and his colleagues grabbed him and restrained him. I was a reporter for a while down in Massachusetts early in my career, and I was actually police and court reporter. There was an incident where a young man was accused of raping the daughter of a police officer, and he ended up being arrested and brought down to the station. And when the victim's father, who's also a senior police officer in this department, heard that this man was there, he was getting ready to basically go and probably commit violence on him, frankly. And the other officers on the scene there basically put him in a chair and just held him there. And,
They'd have to. But, I will tell you, rape is a heinous crime. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a person that I know of that if their daughter was raped, they would have some very adverse reaction to that. I'm not making an excuse for that, but in that case where those officers intervene and grab that officer and restrain him or put him in a chair, they did the right thing. They absolutely did the right thing.
Yeah, and I really have to believe that they did the normal thing in a circumstance like that. It's not
day in and day out, police officers, not only in this state but around the country, do tremendous acts of compassion and goodwill and risk their lives and whatever else. Unfortunately, the actions of these officers, this officer and these officers, they have obscured that in a tremendous way, and they've opened up a chasm of anger and distrust, and the actions of a few have affected many.
We have a listener calling in. Let's go to Fred from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning.
Hey, morning, Fred.
That's very interesting, because my question is, if a civilian was there and he saw what was going on, and the civilian decided that he would interfere with the police to protect that guy with, say, some sort of impact weapon, that civilian probably would have been arrested, if not injured himself. What do you think?
I'm sorry, your voice is a little muffled, Fred. Give it to me.
Yeah, I think Fred's question is about if so these other officers are not intervening, now a civilian who's near the standing nearby and sees this going on, and sees the other officers not intervening, tries to step in, and Fred says with some kind of an impact weapon. I don't know what that would be, but so now the civilian is getting into this melee, and Fred's surmise is that the civilian would end up being injured and probably injured himself or herself.
Or arrested.
Yeah. What do you think, Chief?
Well, that's a dangerous situation for anybody to be in. That's a judgment call, and I would hope that nobody ever has to face that. But I really can't answer that. I would not recommend anybody doing that. But on the other hand, if I saw that and I was in plain clothes, I would intervene, but I wouldn't recommend people doing that. I shouldn't say that. I can't say what that. That's a very, very difficult analogy to answer. You've got to look at your moral compass and think, okay, can I let this happen? If somebody is obviously being choked out, I would expect somebody would step in and intervene, regardless.
Yeah, it's the human reaction.
Of course, deal with the consequences afterwards. I mean, as the question was asked and I was beginning to answer it, I'm thinking to myself, if I was in civilian clothes, would I intervene? Absolutely, I would. Maybe not with an impact weapon. Impact weapon is not the answer, but to grab the officer or maybe pull him off, yeah. But yeah, I wouldn't encourage people to do that because
it'd be very difficult for a civilian to pull a police officer off because there's two more there.
I understand that, but it's one thing.
Fred,
to go in barehanded to pull a guy off, and another thing to have an impact weapon, and that's
yikes.
That's bad. I would not. I would not encourage that.
Fred, thanks for the call. Want to move along here. Chief, talk to me a little bit about, you know, we have had some concern in Vermont about bias. You know, there was a big report out about three or four years ago now, talking about stops. And in this case, it was by the state police. I know you can't really comment on their operations or whatever, but it indicated that when African-Americans were pulled over, they were about something like five times as likely to have their cars searched than a white driver, and actually less likely to have contraband found than white drivers in the car. And so, you know, that was a big headline 3 or 4 years ago. There's been a lot of discussion around this, a lot of work. And I mentioned we had Curtis Reed on the program yesterday, who is continuing to work in this field. Talk to me about, you know, the progress. Do you feel like that the local departments are in your department and others are making progress on these fronts, and et cetera?
I think across the board, law enforcement in the state has become more aware and taken, steps to address these issues. Anytime something like this comes to the forefront, we have a requirement and a responsibility to do that. I know the state police have been very proactive working with Curtis Reed. I know the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council and the legislature have worked together to put together requirements for bias-free policing and conflict de-escalation and resolution. And I know each department, whether it be state police, sheriffs, or municipal, have a requirement to conduct that training with its officers. So I think progress has been made. Can more always be done? Absolutely. Can we always do things better? Of course we can. And when we start thinking we're doing the best job we can, well, then maybe that's time to take a look at it one more time. But I think as a whole, law enforcement in the state has made pretty good steps to address these issues.
In terms of the policing that happens kind of in the wake of an incident like the death of George Floyd, you know, as police respond to these demonstrations, do you feel like in most instances it has been reasonable, or do you think that there have been some times when the police have overreacted to circumstances? A lot of people are pointing to that episode just a day or two ago where the president walked outside the state house to nearby, or, I'm sorry, the White House to, there's a brain cramp for you. Walked outside the White House to a nearby church, and the area was cleared with tear gas and concussion grenades and so on beforehand. And apparently, you know, what people are saying is that it wasn't like there was violence happening. It was just the protesters were there peacefully, and all of a sudden, got quite harshly dealt with. What did you think of that incident and in general overall response since the death of George Floyd?
Well, I can't speak for the Secret Service or you know, the protective services for the president. I wasn't there, so I'm not going to comment on that. That's at a level much higher than I, and I don't know the circumstances, and I don't like to comment when I don't know all the circumstances behind that. I can tell you this, that I know law enforcement right now, the instances I've seen, there have been many instances where law enforcement from around the country have joined hands, met with the people, and supported them in their grief, and their anger, and they understand that. But one thing we don't support, never will support, is the violence against property or people. There's no room for that. Some people feel as though that's the way to get people's attention. It's getting people's attention, but in a lot of cases, adversely so. This conversation is long overdue. It should have been these conversations have been going on for a long time, and obviously something needs to be done. But you know, you're always going to have people or instances or whatever that will cause people to gasp and take a breath because they're so bad. But, you know, we've got to do everything we can each and every day to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen, you know, both in law enforcement and the civilian side of the house. I mean, look at the violence that goes on around our country. This country's become too violent. Every day we read about things in all aspects, and it's just there's no place for this. This is not what America is all about, and we have to do our part, both as civilians, as police officers, to try to bring this to an end. And the way to do it is not through violence. It's not through anger. I mean, anger begets anger. Violence begets violence.
Yeah.
And bad things have come of this. And unfortunately, it's here. It's on our doorstep, and it's maybe not in Vermont, but still in all, we're seeing it, and it affects everybody from the most northern tip of Maine all the way down to the southern tip of Florida and west. Every police agency and every person that watches the evening news is dealing with this terrible situation that's going on in our country right now.
It is terrible. There's no doubt about that. And I want to make the point. And we talked about this earlier this morning when we spoke that, you know, I think the way I put it was that racism does not begin or end at the door of the police station. Certainly, there have been racist incidents just recently that did not involve police officers. Although there was this weird threat in Central Park last week by a woman who said she was going to call the police and I guess maybe try to create it, you know, some kind of a bad incident like along these lines. But that father and son in Georgia who took it upon themselves to enforce some non-existent laws or something in the case of Mr. Arbery, you know, a young man is out jogging, getting some exercise, and he ends up dead. And that's just, you know, there's no excuse for that at all. And again, it did not involve the police until it happened. And certainly this is a sign that this problem of racism in the United States is much more widespread. And we were also talking, Chief, I recall about the about people's education. You know, what can schools do? What can families do to try to raise people with the right kinds of values on this? Which I think, you know, presents a recruiting issue for you. If some percentage of the population has the wrong values, then you have a recruit pool that where you're going to be trying to weed people out. I know it's sometimes tough to find police officers, and so there's a tension there. Tell me about how you sort of test people's values on this kind of stuff and make sure that they are themselves fit to be police officers.
Well, I can tell you that the screening process for police officers has becoming more and more stringent. The Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council has reviewed this in the past, and the if you want to call it quality control or whatnot, has become more and more pronounced, as well it should be. We want the best police officers, the best applicants for police officers wearing our uniform. Obviously, there's an enormous amount of authority and responsibility, regardless of whatever age you enter law enforcement, and we have to make sure we have the right people. Are we always on mark? No. Do we do the best we can? Yes. We have a very extensive screening process, and we do everything we can. And a lot of that is sitting down and talking to the applicant. The applicant has to go through a series of hurdles to get to the point where they become a police officer that's operating on his or her own. And there's a tremendous amount of training. I think just in the basic course of instruction, there's, and don't quote me, I think I'm correct, I think there's 795 hours worth of training that goes to a police officer just in the basic course. And then on top of that, you have a field training officer period of time, which is 120 hours. And then you have post-basic period of time, which is, I think, another 120 hours or so. You've got a lot of time that goes into a police officer. So that initial period of time from the day of an officer walks in the door and says, I want to be a police officer, to the time they graduate from their academy, which certifies them to go out on the road and do work as a police officer, and their field training period, and their probationary period. There is a long time for people to evaluate that officer to see if they're going to cut the mustard as far as being a police officer. I can tell you this, and it's become very, very difficult to become a police officer in today's day and age for the obvious reasons. But we have a job to do. Hopefully we pick the best people. The applicant pool has diminished dramatically for a number of reasons. And I would rather operate shorthanded than operate with people that I don't trust and I don't have confidence in with a tough situation. In this business, tough situations, challenging situations occur on a fairly regular basis. And the best you can do is select the best applicant, provide the best training to that person, adequately equip them. And I think more importantly, you've got the leadership philosophy in each and every agency. It's got to start from the top down, and it's got to be reinforced. You can have all the policies and training you want, but you've got to have that leadership philosophy, and it's got to be reinforced each and every day. And you brought up a good point as far as, you know, when we look for applicants, we look for applicants that have that those core values. When they come to us, they have those core values that we know that they have honor and integrity, and they have compassion. I teach core values at the Vermont Police Academy. I've been teaching there for 19 years now to kids. They get a four-hour block, and then they get a four-hour block in community policing. And I hammer those things home, that it's so important that new recruits understand the importance of their job and what we expect them to have and how one act, innocent it may seem, it can have far-reaching effects.
Well, Chief George Merkel, the Virgins Police, President of the Vermont Police Chiefs Association, thank you very much for joining me this morning. We're about out of time, but I really appreciate you you coming on our air and talking to us about all this.
Dana, one last thing, if I could, I would, in reference to Fred's question, I would hesitate in having people intercede unless in the extreme circumstances.
You
never know what's going on the other side. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Back after a top of the hour break for some CBS News, folks. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Heading into our second hour of this program Wednesday morning, May. May's over, Dave. Come on. We're already up to June the 3rd here, and I'm a man behind the times. I don't know what, but okay. So we are going to be speaking in the next few minutes with Leonard Steinhorn. He's a political consultant with CBS News, and I believe he's on the phone with us right now. Good morning, Leonard.
Yes, good morning to you.
And obviously the big story continues to be, it seems, in the United States right now, these protests and demonstrations all following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis on May 25th. And it sounds like there was a bit of a calmer night last night than some of the previous. Is that right?
Yes, calmer, peaceful protests. And look, most of these protests have been peaceful. Most of the people who are protesting are peaceful. The problem is the few who create the problems and how that escalates into conflict. So, again, I would say that these are peaceful protests, even if we have seen some pretty horrible stuff come out of them, because that's a minority of people committing those acts.
In terms of the minority that is acting out, obviously, you know, a lot of conservative commentators want to blame it all on Antifa. There's a lot of speculation in the more left-leaning parts of the internet that maybe there are some white supremacist groups that are trying to just basically stir up trouble and perhaps get some blame cast in the other direction, et cetera. Is there any evidence emerging to help make either argument?
Well, you hear all of the above, and what happens in a situation like this is when you have mass protests that are met by law enforcement, police, the American military. And I live in downtown Washington, and literally you had drug enforcement agents out there. You had National Park Police out there. You had U.S. military police out there, just about everybody. So when you pit sort of this force of protest against the force of might, things are going to happen. But what then happens is that people seize on these mass protests to create problems. And again, there is evidence that you have people on the far left, the anarchists, Antifa, anti-fascist type people, and you have people on the far right who are seizing this as an opportunity to create unrest and ultimately pin the unrest on the peaceful marchers and the civil rights marchers and the Black Lives Matter marchers, and also just to create chaos themselves. So, you know, these are magnets for people who want to create trouble, which is really unfortunate, because when you think about the goal of the vast, vast majority of people who are marching, I mean, I see these folks streaming past my house and on my street every day, simply with T-shirts that speak to messages about Black Lives Matter or peace and justice or please respect me as a human being. That's what they want to be able to communicate, because the George Floyd murder is sort of a pinhole to a larger history, 400 years of history of you know, racial injustice in this country. And what these young people, primarily young people out there, are saying is, we have to end that injustice now. You have to treat me with the full humanity. We cannot replicate the dehumanization that took place with George Floyd and so many other African Americans throughout our history. We must end that now. So that's a peaceful message. But unfortunately, some of the people who want to create chaos glom onto that and then cause their trouble.
Yeah, one of the things that has developed, this may sound a bit far afield for a moment, but I'll try to tie it back in, that has developed in the 50 years since the civil rights unrest of the 1960s and that era, is that we've had this mapping of the human genome, which I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, and I don't expect you to be extremely well versed, you're a political consultant after all, not a biologist, but I seem to recall that it found that in our basic makeup, we are in excess of 99% all the same, and it strikes me as really an unfortunate fact of history that people have so focused on that last 1% of individuals and we have as a society have created all these divisions of race and nationality and et cetera. I wonder whether should there be some kind of a curriculum, you know, education in our schools that sort of focuses on the idea that when you look at another person, they are not really an other.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's an important point. And there will be, you know, sort of research scientists will say there may be more DNA differences among Europeans than there may be between certain Europeans and Africans. And yep. When you put all of this together, you know, we all bleed red. We all shed tears when something sad comes by. We all have hopes for our children and our families. We all laugh when something is funny. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's our humanity, and it's the social circumstances which divide us, which is why so many people will say that race is a social construction, because in the long run, we are all in this together, notwithstanding any descriptive differences about the color of our skin, but we're all exactly the same. And that what we've done in human history is to divide people based on artificial distinctions. So I think in the long run, you're right. We have to find a way to show the common humanity of people because, you know, if you continue to dehumanize somebody, then in essence, what you're allowing somebody to do is a police officer with hands in pocket, looking unbothered and indifferent, keeping a knee on somebody's neck, and seeing their life snuff out, because that ultimately is dehumanization. You mentioned 1960s, and when you go back to the public protests in 1968, when Martin Luther King went to Memphis, Tennessee, in support of the sanitation workers, what's so interesting is that the placards that they held were not placards about legislation or about rights. What they said was the following: I am a man. And it was all about respecting my human dignity. And I think that really is the core lesson of all of this, from which everything must emanate.
Well, that is a definitely a well put statement there, and I think, I mean, do you think that there needs to be more explicit focus on this particular topic and subject, and really almost curriculum in our schools?
Well, absolutely, and you know what your listeners may not know is my first book was on race relations in this country. It's called By the Color of Our Skin: The Illusion of Integration and the Reality of Race. And what I argued back then 20 years ago, and I continue to argue today, is that this is central to American history. It's not black history. It's American history. It's our history. Nobody owns it in particular because we all own it collectively. And if we don't drill down and understand the roots of where we are today, then as the philosopher George Santayana said, we're condemned to repeat it. So, everybody should be, you know, coming out of school these days with an understanding of that history and how that history led to dehumanization, but how people collectively fought against that dehumanization in ways of reconstruction and civil rights and Black Lives Matter to make sure that society reckons with its past and comes true to the founding principles of this country in which all of us are created equal. So I really think that this needs to be a focus of history, a focus of education, and also because of this. We are a multicultural society. We have to be able to embrace and appreciate and enjoy the diversity that we have, the fact that people come from different backgrounds is what makes America such a unique country. And to be able to build that appreciation of the many backgrounds of American society, that gives us a richer and fuller sense of who we are.
All right. Well, Leonard Steinhorn, CBS News, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. And I'm sorry, what was the name of your book again?
So it's called By the Color of Our Skin, The Illusion of Integration and the Reality of Race, and wrote it in the late 1990s, and
wow,
it's still talked about today, yes.
Huh, very cool. Thank you so much, sir, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, speak soon. Thanks a lot.
We're going to have a discussion about the future of Vermont dairy and whether those farms are going to be remain an important part of our landscape through the next century. We have had a really tough time for the farmers out there. Now we are we have a proposal in the legislature which would put some money into Vermont's dairy industry to try to buoy it up while this pandemic continues and the economic shockwaves emanate. And I saw a blog post this week by Kevin Ellis. He is an occasional guest on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. FM and AM, and it was quite a provocative blog post. I thought it might get some serious pushback from some quarters in Vermont. And the blog post basically, it was, headlined, Big Dairy is Not Essential. And that's essential, of course, is a key word because people talk about essential businesses here. Big Dairy is not essential in the view of Mr. Kevin Ellis, and he is my guest on the radio program this morning. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Dave.
And also, we have on the phone with us Mary White. She and her husband own a dairy farm in Orange County. They have 105 cows, and they are, Mary tells me she's 29 years old, a UVM graduate, and someone who is very, very high on the future of dairying in Vermont, wants to devote her career to it, thinks that there is a future in dairying, and doesn't really doesn't take kindly, as according to our conversations last night with some of the issues raised here by Kevin Ellis. We're going to try to keep this civil here, the two of you, and I trust we will. But I expect there's a pointed conversation to be had here as well. And Mary White, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Mary, I wanted to kind of get this off on the right foot here with you in particular, because I felt as though last evening, you know, you were feeling pretty put upon, and I agree this column would do that to a dairy farmer, I would think, in Vermont, and somebody who wants to defend the dairy industry. I also said to you, and I think you agreed, that this is a sentiment. The sentiments expressed here by Kevin Ellis are fairly common in Vermont among the, you know, non-dairy sectors of the economy. People are, you know, I hear just casual remarks around the neighborhood. If Vermont's farms are going to go under, that may be the nature of capitalism, and why worry about it, or et cetera. And so that's the main reason that I wanted this conversation to happen, because I do think the stakes are quite high here, and that these are important issues. But Kevin Ellis, let me turn to you first and let you make the case, since you kind of went first here, just in the overall chronology of events here. Give me the main couple of points to your column. You oppose this funding that you had estimated at $50 million. I've heard a couple of other sort of figures in the same rough range, but this $50 million in funding, you think, shouldn't happen.
Well, I think, as I said in the blog post, I think it's going to break down to $40 million for directly to dairy, and then a $10 million to other kinds of small dairy and other processors. So I think it's going to be closer to $40 million. And my issue, Dave, is, as I say in the headline, with big dairy. And I, as a former resident for 20 years of Orange County, I don't know where Mary lives, but I don't consider a 105-cow dairy farm big dairy. I'm talking about 500-cow dairy farms and bigger that are polluting our streams, being subsidized. We are asked to be capitalists, and yet we are asked to subsidize a dairy industry that produces a product that that increasingly the marketplace doesn't want, and does not play a key role in feeding, in designing a new food system that feeds hungry Vermonters, and pollutes our streams. And the milk generally goes now to be processed by giant out-of-state dairy co-ops like DFA. And I'm just wondering whether that money should not be better spent creating locally designed food systems that feed Vermonters. Not to mention, I'm talking about big dairy here, not to mention the human trafficking piece, where we as Vermonters, and I am to blame for this myself, turn a blind eye to the fact that non-Vermonters are brought in here to do the work that we don't want to do, and they're illegal, and they're living in the shadows, and I just don't think that's right.
Okay, let me get at some of these points with Mary. Mary, first off, Kevin is arguing that there isn't as much of a market as there used to be for the milk that Vermont's dairy farmers are making. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so I'd like to share just a few statistics on how the dairy economy actually works in the state of Vermont. So right now we have 640 dairy farms in the state. 80% of those farms are certified small farms milking under 200 cows. So we fall into that as a certified small farm. So just to put it in perspective, the state does have numbers on how many farms are in each sector. So the state actually classifies a large farm as over 700 cows, just to put things into perspective. And then between the two, there's a medium farm category as well. But 80% of Vermont farmers are milking under 200 cows. So the dairy industry as a whole is a $2.2 billion economic activity to the state It's the largest agriculture industry in Vermont, accounting for over 70% of the state's agriculture sales. If you added up every other agriculture industry, it doesn't even come close to what dairy brings to the Vermont economy. People are purchasing dairy products in Vermont. We're looking at over $1 million in annual sales just in Vermont alone. That's fluid milk, that's cheese, yogurt, butter, whey, other products as well. And in Vermont, dairy farmers do more than just feed Vermont. We accompany New England states as well. As a whole, Vermont produces 63% of the total milk in New England. So when you say, you know, we're looking at some of these bigger co-ops that ship milk out of state, we're all doing our part to feed the Northeast. Dairy is also one of the top employers in Vermont, providing over 6,000 jobs. So there's a lot here that does show dairy is so important to the state of Vermont. And a recent poll from VPR just from 2019 shows that 93% of Vermonters still support Vermont dairy. That's a huge percentage of people that want to see dairy continue in Vermont. And there's a generation here of young Vermont farmers that want to be able to continue to serve our communities in that aspect. So I would agree that it's really no news to anyone that Vermont farmers have been struggling really all over the country for the past 5 years as we've seen a downturn in milk prices. So as you mentioned earlier, that at the close of 2019 and the start of 2020, the dairy economy was actually starting to rebound, and we were seeing those prices at a profit margin level. And then COVID hit. So now we're looking at costs below production and a lot of other factors that have come into play here. This $40 million proposal isn't asking for a subsidy or any sort of bailout. We actually are one of the only New England states that does not give direct subsidy programs to our dairy farmers. There's nothing in place. I don't even know the last time we actually saw a check from the state for any type of subsidy. So we're just asking for a fair seat at the table to recoup from our pandemic losses.
And once the pandemic is resolved, which we all hope it will be soon, but who knows, I would gather that you would be happy with going back to the sort of status quo as it was before that?
As far as economic activity?
As far as any state support or lack thereof?
So we have worked really hard with our co-ops and processors because milk is priced on a national level. There are, like I said, other New England states that do pitch in for dairy farmers, and through the Farm Bureau we've been working with the Senate Ag Committee and House Ag Committee on some proposals, but no, there's nothing really in place as a plan forward to put any sort of subsidy out there for dairy farmers at this time. So I know there's one issue lingering out there of what happened and why farmers were dumping milk during this pandemic when people so desperately need these nutritional products. So one issue that happened was we lost the wholesale market almost overnight. Workplaces were closing, restaurants were closing, universities, et cetera, and then we saw this increase in panic retail buying. So a lot of these dairy processing facilities are only set up to process wholesale products, so 10 to 50-pound blocks of cheese, large bags of milk, and just packaging that could not easily be sold in a retail setting. So what happened was, is now we have all this milk that's supposed to be in processed by wholesalers with no home. And the retail processors were working around the clock, still are 100 and 110% capacities to try to keep up with the retail demand. But that's where we saw the temporary dislodging of where milk had to be dumped. So I know our local Cabot plants have been running around the clock trying to do all we can to make sure that products are available to people that need them. And dairy farmers are giving back to the community during this time. DFA, I know you mentioned earlier, they initiated a milk giveaway in northern New York that was graciously received by the community. We're working with school lunch programs to make sure free milk is a part of every single lunch at home for the students. We've worked with the Vermont Agency of Ag, the Vermont Food Bank, to donate 2 tractor trailer loads of product to be given to the Vermont Food Bank to be processed into fluid milk and yogurt for donations. So farmers are actively helping during this pandemic, and we just want to be given the opportunity to continue to be able to do that when this is all over.
Yeah. Kevin Ellis, let me ask you just a couple minutes ago before our bottom of the hour break for some CBS news, but maybe we can squeeze one question from me to Kevin in, and that is other industries are getting help. The restaurant industry is getting help. I'm not arguing that any of these are undeserving, by the way. Certainly our hospitals are getting a lot of state help, and other sectors of our economy. Why not dairy?
Because I think it's first of all, I think Mary's Farm should get help. And I'm not talking about a 105-cow dairy farm. I'm talking about a 1,500-cow dairy farm that's 2 miles from my house that sprays atrazine and glyphosate all over its fields and pollutes everybody's water supply. And the amount of money that we're going to have to spend in Vermont to clean up the pollution of big dairy is so far beyond our budgetary means that our legislature doesn't know what to do about it. I am all for a 105-cow dairy farm, and I think there's a compromise here between Mary's view and mine, and that is tie the $50 million to the kinds of water standards and shift to organic and the kind of putting cows out on grass, getting them out of confinement, and to the kinds of practices that are best practices in dairy, which no doubt she pursues. But it's not large dairy farms.
Yeah, I got to interrupt right here because we do need to go to this CBS News Minute at 10:30, and then a couple words from our sponsors. And I want to get Mary to now maybe address this compromise Kevin is talking about as we return from the bottom hour of the break. In the last 30 seconds before we go, I want to mention just after 11 o'clock, we're going to have another one of our news conferences with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials on the COVID-19 response. Those folks have been doing that every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Today's Wednesday. We'll be carrying it live on WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay tuned for more of The Dave Graham Show. Coming back at you in a couple minutes.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back and continuing our conversation with Mary White. She's a dairy farmer in Orange County, has a farm with 105 cows, qualifies as a certified small dairy farm in Vermont, she tells us. And the other guest is Kevin Ellis. Kevin wrote a very provocative blog post this week urging against any special state aid to dairy farmers to cope with the COVID-19 crisis, and saying that essentially dairying in Vermont, at least large dairying, now we've refined it, I think, the argument a little bit, but large dairying shouldn't get any state aid and should, in Kevin's view, be diminishing over time. And Kevin, correct me. How am I doing so far? Am I summing up your position reasonably well?
You're doing great.
Okay. Thanks. And Mary White, I wanted to get you to react to a couple of things Kevin was saying right before we went into the break, which is that he doesn't have any problem with a 105-cow dairy operation. He is more worried about the larger farms. He faults them, their uses of pesticides or herbicides, et cetera. He faults their tendency to pollute some of our streams. And so let me turn your attention to those. Do you see any problems there, or do you think that these are all manageable and that we should be hoping for the continued thriving of our larger dairy farms as well?
Yeah, so I definitely appreciate the support for our farm, and it's appreciated, but I do support all farms, and whether they're small farms, medium farms, or large farms, what I feel has happened over the years is there is a generational gap between the family farm and where farms are at today. So within the last 30 years, there was a large exit from dairy farming, and now nationally, the kids that are in school now are 5 to 7 generations removed from the family farm. So a lot has happened over those years, and we've seen, you know, in the 1980s, milking a few hundred cows was a lot, and now here we are in 2020. As Kevin pointed out, we've got farms milking over 1,000 cows. And really what happened was is family farms saw an avenue to grow their business, really no different than your local hardware store. But unlike the hardware stores, these farms are not typically open to the public, which left a huge disconnect in what's actually happening. So if I'm, you know, a small farm versus someone who's milking 1,000 cows, we are all required to follow the same practices. And Vermont farmers have worked, no matter what size their farm is, have worked continuously with organizations to protect our waterways. So, for example, let's tackle the pollution topic for a second here. Agriculture was deemed responsible for 41% of the phosphorus in Lake Champlain. And we've been tasked with the daunting figure of a 67% reduction from agriculture. So we're actually being asked to clean up more than we were deemed responsible for, which is fine. And farmers all over the state of Vermont, large farms, small farms, medium farms, what have you, have really banded together to answer this call and step up our practices to be able to reduce runoff pollution and be a part of the solution of water quality. So, for example, the recent data shows from 2016 to 2019, agriculture is responsible for an average of 98% of the estimated reduction into the lake for phosphorus. So that's a huge number from agriculture alone. And that's not just coming from small farms. That's all of us working together. That's every single farm. We're working with UVM Extension. We're working with the Department of Natural Resources. We're using nutrient management plans, no-till practices, cover crops, crop rotations, and we're actually one of the only few industries that can help rebuild the soil, preventing future soil erosion and runoff. So I think to say that one small farm versus a large farm should be getting funding is completely out of line. We're all in this together, and we're all working towards the same common goal.
And all right, we have
the
a couple.
Organic market, just one comment on the organic market. So the organic market is closed. If I wanted to transition organic, that is not possible. That market has been closed for a few years. They signed up a lot of farms. A lot of farms transitioned to organic, but that's not a thing anymore. Their market is closed. They have quotas. They have all the milk they need. I would not be able to get a market for my milk if I transitioned organic or even to 100% grass farming. The markets are completely closed right now. And this was before COVID. This is backdating a few years that this market has not been available for new farms or transitioning farms.
Okay. I did want to bring in a couple of callers. I believe we have Mike from Moortown. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. My heart goes out to the farmers, and it really broke watching them having to dump all that milk. My question is, why aren't they processing it as non-fat dry milk? Because that's what I buy. I don't use a lot of milk, so I buy the dry milk and make it as I need it. Is it just not financially feasible?
Okay. Good question. Mary, what can you tell us on that front?
Yeah, so I'll tell you from our, so from Cabot Agrimark, we have the capability to produce that product, and we are already running our capacity for that, and this is pre-COVID, at 100% capacity. So we are making that product. We are continuing to make that product, but we were not able to take any excess milk and use it into that system because we were just maximizing our facility already.
Okay. Mike, did you have something else?
Yeah. Is it feasible to up this this capacity? I just did a little math. I buy it in a really large bag, 64 ounces, and it makes 20 quarts. At $1.75, that would cost me $35. I'm only paying $15 a bag.
Yeah, and it's a great product to use, but at the same standpoint, everything was shutting down, and so it made it really hard. You know, we couldn't just go out and buy a new dryer to put in our facility overnight. That's something that takes capital, that we've got to have people to work on it, install it. We've got to then hire more employees to run the line. So it's really unrealistic for us to be able to do that during a pandemic. Definitely something we might look at down the road, but it's not something we were able to achieve with everything going on.
Yeah,
a lot of companies have been canceling capital investments as opposed to adding them in this time of the pandemic. So, Mike, I do have to move along. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Jeff in Moncton. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey guys, morning. Just a couple of comments. To me, it seems like Kevin doesn't have a problem with farms. It seems like he has a problem with his neighbor. It just everything he's been saying, it seems to be turning back to the neighbor 3 miles down the road. And then the next comment I want to make is, you know, we're talking all of this about dairy and dairy farms and stuff like that. But what about the rest of us that are struggling, the people that are raising animals that are non-dairy animals? The people that are raising the beef animals and the chevron and the lamb and the pork and stuff like that, and chicken, obviously. We're struggling just as much, but yet we never get any talk about anything at all. The real small guys like I am that are utilizing the on-the-farm process for all of the new Americans, you know, that Vermont's inviting in, you know, we're handicapped in a way that, you know, we can only help and support so many people before we have to basically shut our doors.
What kind of an operation do you have over there in Moncton? What sorts of animals?
So I raise goats, okay,
uh-huh.
and I'm certified for on the farm process slaughter.
Yep.
And my primary customer are new Americans. Okay.
Hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to explain this to my representatives and the governor the couple of times I've had a chance to speak with him, that, you know, Vermont has an extremely, you know, good open door policy, and honestly, it's one of the reasons that I'm staying in Vermont, you know, opposed to all the everything else that's trying to drive people away, is that we don't close our doors. You know, we don't close our borders. You know, we tell people, come in, you know, live here, you know, prosper and stuff like that. The mm-hmm. thing that people don't understand is these people come from their countries, from their places where they grew up and the traditions that they grew up with. They don't want to go to the grocery store and buy packaged meat. You know, they don't want to go to the grocery store and buy packaged vegetables. So they come to us little farmers who are only allowed to process 40 animals a year. And you know, I'm not going to lie to you, 40 animals a year, if I could grow enough quick enough, I could sell that in a month. You know, on my farm, I'm able to do a couple of months here and there, because that's just what I, you know, have the capability of growing. But we're so limited for these people, and it never gets talked about.
Okay, so Jeff, I actually also on this one need to move it along, but I kind of cut into the chase here. It sounds like you're saying that you would like to see, if there's going to be subsidies for dairy, why not subsidies and some help for other types of farmers? Is that fair?
That's exactly what I'm trying to point out.
Okay. Mary White, what do you make of that argument?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good piece of the conversation. And as I mentioned before, you know, Vermont does have 70% of agriculture sales in dairy, being, you know, the largest agriculture industry. So as an industry as a whole, we have a lot to lose, and I know a lot of small farms do as well. I encourage you to continue to contact your representatives in the State House, and even, you know, work with some folks at the Vermont Farm Bureau. And maybe every situation is different, but that retail market he's talking about, I would assume, is booming right now. I know we have a lot of vegetable farms in our area and people that do retail beef, and again, they're feeding the people, and they're meeting that demand to keep their business afloat. So they're not seeing huge losses.
That is a good point, Mary. I mean, I actually had a couple of meat farmers. One person does grass fed beef, and another person who does a range of beef and chickens and pork and et cetera. And I learned from them that with all the fears surrounding the national food distribution chain, you know, with the COVID-19 outbreaks in the meatpacking plants out in the Great Plains and so on, there's been a huge upward bump in demand for locally raised meat products here in Vermont. And so these folks were actually in the winter and early spring this year seemed to be brimming. You know, it was strong economy for that sector of agriculture. And so that was the interesting conversation there. Kevin Ellis, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you think that that if we are subsidizing some farms, we should be spreading it out more?
Absolutely. And your caller is the perfect example of the new markets that are developing in agriculture that we need to support. Dave, I would go back to what Mary said last time, and I live 20 years in Orange County, and I think I know exactly where she lives. We have been having this conversation for 30 years. Back when we had 1,500 dairy farms, and we're now down to just over 600, these Vermonters are captives of a federally subsidized system that keeps them doing this. And we are prisoners of this notion that Vermont is still speckled with 20 cow hill farms, and it's no longer the case. I support those hill farms. I support those small to medium-sized farms if they're not polluting the industry and bringing illegal immigrants to do the work that we don't want to do. But why should we be subsidizing 1,500 to 2,000 cow dairy farms that are polluting the streams that we have to clean up, that don't produce anything that people want? I want to buy from Kimball Brook Dairy or Butterworks Farm to Jack Laser up in the Kingdom. That's where I buy my products. It just makes no sense. These are no longer farms. They are agriculture behemoths that make a product that no longer can survive in the marketplace.
Well, Mary, let me get your response to some of this, because, I mean, you are a member of Cabot AgriMark, which is a large dairy cooperative. You are farming in, I think, conventional way, from what I gather you're telling us. And so to some extent, even though you're a small farm, it sounds like Kevin is aiming a bit at what you do. So talk to us about your sense of his critique there. I mean, are we in a situation? Well, let me narrow it down, and we'll break it down in a couple different questions. One, what do you think about this argument that the federal pricing system makes Vermont's farmers captives or prisoners or whatever?
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, 80% of Vermont farms are still under 200 cows, and I feel like I can't say that enough. AgriMark farms, the majority of AgriMark farms are also small farms. I think it's even higher than that figure. And we are still family farms. I know these people. I know these families that operate these quote-unquote large farms that you're talking about, milking 1,000 cows or more. And again, we all follow the same regulation practices. Whether we're on my farm growing 90 acres of corn or we're on my friend's farm that is growing 700 acres of corn, we are all following the same practices. We are all contributing, as I said before, to improve our water quality. And we've come such a long way. And large farms are such a huge part of this as well, because they take care of a lot of the land just as much as the small farms do. So we really need to see this as an industry as a whole. And again, I don't think it's fair to be singling out large family farms versus small family farms. We are all family farms, and we all do our part in the Vermont system. As far as the national pricing goes, we do have an issue nationally with the way milk is priced. I think there comes a point in any industry when your supply increases the demand for a product, you see a decrease in pricing. And I know at Vermont Farm Bureau, we're working with neighboring states, we're working with local co-ops, even American Farm Bureau, to try to see how we can better price milk to be able to have a sustainable future for our dairy farmers.
Let's go to another listener calling in. Karen from Hardwick is on the line. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. I just want to say that I think it's absurd to subsidize people who are employing illegals. And they are the very people who are flooding the market with cheap milk and killing off little farms like us.
Okay, thank you for the call, Karen. Mary, we've had a couple mentions of this now. I have to ask you about it. And that is the concerns about undocumented immigrants who are working on Vermont's dairy farms. What do you make of this issue? Is it something that is a real problem for dairy farms? Is it something that is actually where the blame lies elsewhere? Or how do you describe this in your own mind?
I think there's a lot of misconception out there. You know, I know a lot of farms that do have migrant workers, and they enjoy working here. They want to be here. They like the opportunity to support their families. You know, it's not a doom and gloom situation. They have living accommodations, and there are many groups out there that make sure that these rights are in place for these employees.
And are you finding that as time goes on, any of them or many of them are looking to settle in Vermont? Is it really more of they consider it kind of a temporary sojourn where they come up here for a few years or something and make enough money to send back to their families south of the border and then go back and rejoin them eventually? What is the pattern here, and are there any changes in the pattern?
It works both ways. There are plenty of workers who bring their families with them, and they've been here for 10 plus years. You know, but that's not mm-hmm. uncommon.
And do you employ any of the migrant workers on your own farm?
No, we do not. I do not feel like that's a fair question, but no, we do not.
Okay. And I'm wondering if you think that should U.S. immigration law be changed to allow more of this and allow it sort of to happen without all the worries about, people working in the shadows and so on?
Look, and I think we're getting very off topic here when it comes to funding. Immigration and the migrant workers are part of agriculture as a whole. This is in no way, shape, or form just specific to dairy. This is a much larger issue on the scale of things. And I just think we're getting a little off topic here when it comes to dairy farming. This is a much more national issue with all of agriculture combined, not just dairy, that use migrant workers.
Dave?
Yes, Kevin.
I just want to, first of all, I want to thank Mary for doing this. This is a really hard topic. It's emotional, and my blog post kind of strikes at the heart of, the Vermont experience, and I think there's compromise here. I think there's a middle ground, and I'm grateful that we're just having the conversation beyond sort of the same conversation we were having 30 years ago. I think this is beneficial, and I think there's a middle ground. I think if we start saying to these big farms that are polluting our environment, listen, you should get an Act 250 permit. You should stop spraying atrazine on your corn. You should be putting your cows out on grass in the summer and not confine them 24/7. And I got to say, with regard to the migrant labor, I support migrant workers 100%. But I'll tell you, when Mary refers to the housing that they have, I wouldn't put my children in that housing. And I think there should be requirements around that, too. If we're going to allow these farms to be this big, and we're going to subsidize them, they need to adhere to certain guidelines and regulations around environment and human rights.
And let me just say this one more time, that, again, we keep coming back to this aspect that these large farms are not following the regulations. They are following the same regulations that we are on our small farms. you know, it seems to be a disconnect in the conversation here that the large farm is somehow breaking all these rules where myself on my perfect little 105 cow farm are following all the rules. That is not the case. We are all in this industry together, and we are all following the same regulations.
Right, or lack thereof, meaning no Act 250 permit for agriculture. That needs to change.
Mary, what do you think about...
Well, we're talking about pollution here, and, you know, you're talking about pesticide and herbicide application, which are two different relevant issues, but there are, you know, applications for herbicides have to be done by licensed applicators, whether you're doing 1 acre of corn or, again, 500 acres of corn. There are strict documentations that have to be documented, and there's so much technology and engineering behind these products now that they are the safest products that have been used in agriculture to date, and they allow us to use much less. Whether you're a large farm, again, in Vermont, you are a family farm, and your family lives on that farm. We care about our families. We care about our communities. We care about our waterways, our animals, and the environment. We are in no way just blasting chemicals into the air because we think that's okay. That is not what is happening here. There is strict licensing, application, documentation that has to happen for any pesticide, herbicide application, and we are doing our part to improve the waterways. As I said before, the data is there to support that, and I just wish that the public could get behind this concept that all farms are trying to do the right thing here, and we are working towards a better Vermont and a healthier Vermont.
Well, Mary White, I think that is an excellent summation of your case, and I really appreciate you joining me this morning to talk about these issues. I agree with Kevin. It's not always an easy conversation, but it's an important conversation, and the fact that you are willing to participate is to be commended. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alrighty, Kevin Ellis, I appreciate you joining me this morning. Another provocative blog post and something that got this conversation off and going. And as I say, it's an important conversation. So your contribution here is definitely welcome as well. I appreciate you joining me this morning.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Mary.
Alrighty, we got about a minute or so to go here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. I wanted to mention one more time that we are just after 11 o'clock, as we've been doing every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in recent weeks. We have been going to a WDEV live broadcast of these regular news conferences with Governor Phil Scott. Top state officials. They're going to be talking about the latest developments in the response to the COVID-19 crisis by state government. We'll be back with another edition of the Dave Graham Show tomorrow. I hope you'll join us then. And in the meanwhile, keep washing hands and stay healthy and remain vigilant against the coronavirus. We will be talking with you tomorrow. Have a good afternoon, everybody.